against his anointed, saying, "Let us break their chains and throw off their shackles." The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. He rebukes them in his anger and terrifies them in his wrath, saying, "I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. I will proclaim the Lord's decree. He said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have become your father. Ask me, and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You will break them with a rod of iron. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. Therefore, you kings, be wise. Be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and celebrate his rule with trembling. Kiss his son or he will be angry and your way will lead to destruction. For his wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are all who take refuge in him."
Thanks. I'm going to hand it to Ben. Thanks, Ben.
Great. Do keep that passage open. We will be kind of anchoring in there, but jumping a few other places as we go. Let me lead us in a prayer. Father in heaven, thank you for your word. Thank you that it gives us all that we need for this life. Father, please, would we hear you speak this afternoon. Amen. As you spend time with friends, family, loved ones, neighbours, colleagues, whoever it is, if you get talking to them about the resurrection, you will very quickly discover that people have some pretty divergent opinions about it. Here are three that we're going to consider. Firstly, some people believe the resurrection is incredible. And by that, I don't mean like it's really great. Incredible in its literal sense, that is not credible. Many of the people we know think that the resurrection is just an absolute nonsense, a fairy tale. There's a chance that some of us in this room think that. A few years ago, I can't quite remember exactly when this happened, but I know it was pre-pandemic, so that kind of roughly dates it. I remember a time when a boiler engineer came to our house to fix a problem with our boiler. I'm one of those really annoying people who, if a workman comes, I just try and chat to them while they're trying to focus on their job. So I got chatting to him, and he was asking what I did, and at that point I was at Bible college training for ministry. And so he kept asking me lots of questions about being a Christian, what I believed. And then he said to me, "But you don't really believe that Jesus rose from the dead, do you?" And then when I looked at him and said, "Yes, actually I do," his face just completely changed. He had no idea what to say. He had no category to put someone who believes that kind of thing in. It was as if an alien had just landed from a foreign planet in my attic. No idea what to do with that. Because the way our society thinks today, it will say no rational person would ever believe that someone can rise from the dead. It's utter nonsense. Who could possibly do that? And so in our society, the resurrection is attacked and called fairy tale. Not credible. According to one survey, never quite sure how these surveys are done, but a quarter of professing Christians don't believe Jesus rose from the dead, apparently. People think the resurrection is incredible, but it is not credible. It might be that that's true for some of you in this room. If it's not true for you, it will be true for your friends, your family, your neighbours, your colleagues. For a lot of them, they will think the resurrection is not credible as you pass on the street today. That's option one. Option two is that the resurrection is irrelevant. And I think there's kind of a Christian and a non-Christian way of viewing the resurrection as irrelevant. Let me start with the non-Christian way, which is it's not so much that they don't believe it's possible, it's just they don't see how it could possibly matter. See, who cares what happened to one bloke 2,000 years ago? Why would that possibly make any difference to my life? So says the non-Christian who thinks the resurrection is irrelevant. But here's, I think, the danger for us as Christians is that we slip into thinking that the resurrection is irrelevant. And to grasp how that works, I want you to imagine a cream egg. I was going to bring one, but almost to benefit my point, you can't really buy them in shops at this time of year. See what happens with cream eggs. I'm a big cream egg fan. I don't know about you. Between February and April, cream eggs are everywhere. I love them. I eat them. And then May comes around, and I kind of forget they exist until it gets back to the February after, when all of a sudden they're back in the shops again, and they couldn't be more relevant. See the point? Cream eggs, relevant to Easter, irrelevant the rest of the year. I think as Christians, we very quickly slip into the habit of thinking that the resurrection is a bit like that. See, we get to Easter time and we preach sermons about the resurrection. We talk about the resurrection. It gets to Easter Sunday and we greet everyone in church by saying, "He is risen." We text all of our Christian friends, "He is risen." And then May swings around and the resurrection doesn't really feature in our thinking very much. I don't know if you've ever had that experience. I think it's a danger for a lot of Christians. In one sense, what I'm going to try and do for the rest of our time together is convince you that the resurrection is not like a cream egg. Which, given that none of you walked in thinking that that was the case, hopefully none of you will now walk out thinking it is. I want to convince you that the resurrection is not something that is only relevant one Sunday a year, or a week a year, or a fortnight a year, or a month a year. No, it is relevant every day if you're a Christian. Couldn't be more so. Because the third option, so the resurrection, some people see as incredible, others see as irrelevant. The third option is that the resurrection is indispensable. That is, we cannot live without it. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. See, to the Apostle Paul, there couldn't be anything more important than the resurrection. Because without the resurrection, everything else is useless. But if that's how we think, without the resurrection, everything is useless when it comes to our faith. That word useless carries the kind of connotation with it of emptiness. So I want you to picture the kind of brand new iPhone box. I don't know what number we're at now. We're about iPhone 13, something like that. Picture the kind of brand new iPhone box. It promises so much. You come up to it. It's been given to you. You open it. And there's nothing inside. Promises lots, delivers nothing. Absolutely empty. That box is useless, irrelevant. Paul is saying that Christianity without the resurrection is about as useful as that iPhone box. See, it might promise lots, it might look great on the outside, but it delivers nothing. All hope, no substance. And so, Paul says, effectively, if the resurrection didn't happen, because Christianity is based on a lie, it should be rejected out of hand. And so I'm going to stand this afternoon and tell you that if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, what you're doing here right now is an absolute waste of your time. It is an absolute waste of your time. No one should be a Christian. Churches should close. We should give up on what we're doing. Every church building in this country should be sold off and become flats or restaurants or whatever else, it doesn't matter. Jesus didn't rise from the dead. You should all stop wasting your Sunday afternoons and find a different hobby. You should go home and watch the women's Euros or whatever else. So without the resurrection, it's all a waste of time. That's what Paul says. But Paul goes on to say, Christ has been raised from the dead. That happened in history 2,000 years ago. And so this is not a waste of our time. It is not a waste at all. There's so many ways we could see how the resurrection impacts our life. This talk comes from a series I did on kind of four different ways the resurrection impacts our life. There are loads more than just those four, but here's what we're going to see this afternoon. We're going to see that the resurrection shows us that Jesus is the one who is in charge. The resurrection shows us that Jesus is the one who is in charge. Two halves of what we're going to see. Firstly, the raised one is crowned. The raised one is crowned. I got Psalm 2 read because we're basically going to be anchoring in the whole of Psalm 2, but particularly Psalm 2, verse 7. That's kind of where we're zeroing in on. That decree of the Lord, he said to me, "You are my son. Today I have become your father." Which raises an obvious question. So this is David speaking, but prefiguring Jesus. When was that day? When was that day when the Father became, so to speak, Father to the Son. When did that happen? Well, Acts 13, Paul quotes these words and refers to this as happening at Jesus' resurrection. Refers to it as happening at Jesus' resurrection. So it's not that Jesus isn't the Son of God eternally. He is. But it's that something changes at the resurrection. And what changes is that Jesus is publicly declared to be the Son of God. So before the resurrection, Jesus is the Son, but as the resurrection, he is publicly declared to be so. Help us see that. Let's flick to Romans 1. We had that read earlier in the service, but Romans chapter 1, which as I flick there with you, I'll then shout out to the page when I get there. 1:1-8, Romans chapter 1. Phil read these words. If you've turned there, great. If not, you don't need to worry. You can just listen. Paul speaking about the gospel. He says that this gospel is regarding his son, verse 3, Jesus, who as to his earthly life was a descendant of David, and who through the Spirit of holiness was appointed the Son of God in power. How was he appointed the Son of God in power? By his resurrection from the dead. See, it is at the resurrection that Jesus is appointed the Son of God in power. Again, not that he becomes the Son, he already is Son eternally. But that is publicly declared to all at the resurrection. If that's a concept that's quite hard to get our heads around, here's where the correlation is really helpful. So most, if not all of us in this room, weren't alive when the coronation happened. I won't ask if anyone was. But when the coronation happened, it wasn't that that was the day that the queen became the queen, right? So the queen became queen the day her dad died in 1952. And yet, it wasn't until, if I get my dates right, the 6th of February 1953, I think, that she was coronated. She was crowned. In that 9 months or so that intervened that period, it wasn't that she wasn't in charge. She was. But the public declaration of her rule didn't happen until a few months later. That is the idea that Paul is using here. That is, he is saying that Jesus has always been the Son of God, and yet that is declared, that appointment is formalized, that appointment is announced at his resurrection. That is the moment where the whole world is told in abundant clarity, this is my Son. This is my Son. I have appointed him as the Son of God. Hints are given, you know, we see it at Jesus' baptism, we see it at the Transfiguration. But that day today is the resurrection. That is the moment where Jesus is publicly declared to be the Son of God, where he is crowned, coronated. That phrase, Son of God, is often used in the first century. It's often attached to emperors. So if you go to the right museum at the right time, you'll find kind of coins that say things like Caesar Augustus, the Son of God. Because what emperors used to do in the first century is to kind of justify their power, to justify their authority, they used to say, well, I'm basically descended from the divine. I'm going to claim the title for myself, Son of God. And because I have that title, I have the right to rule you. Because I'm somehow from a different class or category. I'm kind of intermingled with the divine in some way. Jesus doesn't claim this title for himself. He is given it by the Father. It is rightfully his, and it always has been his. Jesus has the authority to rule in a completely different way from any human leader. He doesn't claim divinity. He is divine. Jesus is king. Jesus is crowned. Jesus reigns and rules. One of the problems with this picture of Jesus as king in our culture is that our kings and queens don't really have any actual substantial power. And so the danger is that we start to think that Jesus is a king in the same way the queen's the queen, where they just kind of sit on a throne and don't really do very much. That's not a dig at the queen. She does loads of wonderful things, but she doesn't have power because she chooses not to exercise it. That is not the kind of king that Jesus is. Flick back to Psalm 2, page 543. Nice, easy to remember, isn't it? 543. Psalm 2, verse 1. What's the picture in Psalm 2? It's of a worldwide, powerful rebellion. Verses 1 to 3, the nations, the peoples conspire together, the kings of the earth rise up, the rulers band together against the Lord and against his anointed. That was true in David's day, but true more clearly in Jesus' day as Jewish leaders and Gentile authorities, Roman rulers, plot together against Jesus, against the Lord, against his anointed. What's God's response to that challenge to his authority? Verse 4, he laughs, he scoffs, he rebukes, verse 5, he terrifies, and he installs a king. So in response to people's rebellion against him, he says, I have a king and he is on the throne. That is the resurrection moment. That king who, verse 8, is the Son. And that king, so verse 7, who is the Son, that king who, verse 8, rules the nations, the ends of the earth. There is nothing that is outside of Jesus' rule, not a single thing. And he is the kind of king with absolute power and authority, verse 9. He can break them with a rod of iron, dash them to pieces like pottery. Absolute, total authority. According to these words, Vladimir Putin, in the hands of Jesus, like a piece of pottery, breakable in an instant. That is the kind of power and authority Jesus has. And Jesus calls those who come to him, who recognize him, to serve the Lord with fear, celebrate his rule, kiss the Son, and take refuge in him. Jesus rules. Jesus rules his kingdom, and Jesus says to those who are part of his kingdom, this is the kind of king I am, and you need to submit, to serve, to celebrate. That's the first thing we see. The raised one is crowned. So Jesus doesn't just go from the grave to life. He goes from the grave all the way up to the throne. From the grave to the throne. And from the throne, he will judge. The raised one is crowned. Secondly, the crowned one will judge. The crowned one will judge. We're going to spend the rest of our time in Acts chapter 17. So do turn there. I'll shout out a page number again when I get there. 1:1:4. Acts chapter 17, starting at verse 30. I'll read a couple of verses from there. Acts chapter 17, starting at verse 30, says this. Famous words, well-known words to many of us, I'm sure. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance. But now, he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. How are we to know if that's true? He has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. Judgment is coming. Judgment is real. According to these verses, judgment is utterly inescapable. Verse 30, all people everywhere are commanded to repent. The world will be judged. Wonderfully, he will judge the world with justice. Good news, isn't it? I don't know how many times a day you long for justice. Probably many, in small micro moments, and some in bigger moments as you read terrible news stories. Judgment is going to come, and it will bring about total justice. And when we doubt that is going to happen, what God says to us with these words is remember the resurrection, because the resurrection is like a big neon arrow pointing at Jesus, saying this is the guy who is going to judge. He is the one who I have given total authority to. He's going to do it. Because the honest truth is, as we look around horizontally, it doesn't really look like Jesus is going to come and judge the world, does it? Sounds a bit more like a fantasy than anything. Kind of quirky thing to believe. To believe that one day, metaphorically, if not literally, everyone who's ever lived will be lined up, one next to another. I don't know how many people that will be, depends how long the world keeps on going. Maybe 100 billion or so people. For all of them to be lined up, for each one of them to be individually, one by one, judged by Jesus. Sounds a bit like nonsense. Sounds unlikely. A nice fairy tale so that we know that the story all ends happily ever after as justice is finally done. It doesn't look very likely as we look around. No sign of it. Doesn't look like the world's going to end. Not in our lifetime. Maybe the last couple of years actually looks more and more like the world's going to end, but not because Jesus is going to come back. More so, we look around, we think, well, the world's going to end either because of a Russia-instigated World War III or because of the climate emergency. It's so easy to think that those are the things that are going to end the world. That's what our journalists would have us believe. But God says that's not how the world will end. See, the coronation marks out the queen. It says the queen is someone different. The queen is someone special. The queen is someone important. At her coronation, she's given a thing in either hand, a rod in one hand and a scepter in another, to mark out that she is the one who has the authority to judge. Now, the way that the queen exercises her authority to judge is by delegated authority. So she delegates her authority to the police and to the courts and to things like that. Jesus is the one who ultimately and truly has utter authority to judge everyone who's ever lived. And we know that because he rose from the dead. So what's our response? Well, firstly, verse 30, he commands all people everywhere to repent. So it'd be remiss of me to ask whether or not you've done that. Most of us in this room, I guess, have. Maybe all of us have. We haven't bowed the knee to Jesus, we need to. There's one day coming where it'll be too late. But for most of us who have recognized Jesus as King, who have repented, who have bowed the knee to him, we need to proclaim this news to others, don't we? It's one of the things that at Woody Road we're thrilled about as we hear of things that are going on here at GCK, is stories of people sharing the gospel with others. Stories of people coming to events, stories of people hearing about Jesus, stories of baptisms. It's a wonderful encouragement to know that Jesus is being proclaimed. Keep on doing it, because one day the world will be judged with justice. And on that day, only those who have recognized that they have not lived rightly, who have recognized that the Son, Jesus, has died for them, only they will receive a welcome to God's eternal. The resurrection makes it abundantly clear that Jesus is King. The resurrection isn't a cream egg. It's not only interesting and relevant for a couple of months a year. Couldn't be more essential, because it reminds us of who's really in charge. Because as we go about our day-to-day lives, it doesn't really feel like Jesus is in charge, does it? Think about this on different levels. Think about the media. How does the media portray Jesus? How does it portray Christians? Not very positively. It doesn't give them much airtime. If it does, it normally gives them airtime to try and tear them apart. It doesn't feel like Jesus is King on the airwaves, on the television. As those who follow him are outnumbered, are belittled, are mocked even, opposed on issues we hold so dearly, whether issues of sexuality and marriage, issues of gender, issues of abortion, issues of tolerance, whatever it will be, Christians opposed at every turn. If the media are kind of fairly aggressive in their approach, my experience in the workplace, maybe it's different for you, is not aggression against Christians, but just pure apathy. People just don't care. You try and talk to them about Jesus, and every conversation is either closed down or kept really superficial. Oh, that's a really interesting thing for you. I'm glad that you find that helpful. We don't really want to know. Because the king in the office, it's not Jesus. It's the line manager, the promotion, whatever else. Sunday is a time where God's people gather together, a kind of oasis in the desert of life. And yet, there are even times on a Sunday where it doesn't really feel like Jesus is king, does it? We're thrilled to hear of kind of growth here at GCK, and I'm aware loads of people are away because it's the holidays at the moment. But even if everyone were here, and even if there were a few guests as well, how many people would be here on a Sunday? What percentage of Kidlington is that? It's not to say you guys are doing a bad job at all. It's just the reality. Church life, as we look around, can feel really weak. We can feel like we are a drop in the ocean. Fractional numbers of this village know Jesus. What we do Sunday by Sunday here at Woody Road, wherever else it may be, just doesn't feel that impressive. Same's true on the building sites. Same's true at the school gate. The same's true with your neighbours. Wherever you go, it just doesn't really feel like Jesus is the king. Your felt experience day to day is of exactly the opposite. That Jesus is ignored. That Jesus is irrelevant. Think of Kidlington Gala last week, which we came along to as a family. You guys had a stall, and Phil's kind of told me little snippets. Some conversations happened, kind of a few people took literature. I imagine most people just walked by or played the game to get the sweet for their child and then walked by. That might have been what we mainly did. Most people just aren't really that interested. When we have those moments where we feel that acutely, where we feel people just not being interested, and it starts to make us question, is this really true? Is this really worth it? We all have those moments. Maybe we don't admit them, but we all have them. What do you do in that moment? Why not ask yourself this question this week? What does the resurrection tell me about what's really going on? What does the resurrection tell me about what's really going on? Because as we fix our eyes on the resurrection, Paul tells us that it will remind us that Jesus has been crowned and that he will come to judge. Has been crowned. He is sitting as king in heaven right now. A day is coming where he will come to judge. The resurrection shows us what our eyes can't see. And so as we live by faith and not by sight, we need to fix our spiritual eyes on that empty tomb. Remember that it is empty. Jesus is in heaven. He is the king. But he will judge. And that this is all worth. Resurrection isn't incredible. It's not irrelevant. It is indispensable. And so our preaching is not useless, and neither is your faith, because Christ has been raised. Let me leave this in a prayer. Father in heaven, we just simply praise you for the resurrection of Jesus. We praise you that he has been raised, that he is ruling as king, and that he will come back to judge. So tempting to doubt those things. And so, Father, please help us to fix our spiritual eyes on the empty tomb. And would that spur us on to keep going when it doesn't feel worth it, when it doesn't look like Jesus is really king, when it all just feels too hard or too unlikely. Please do that work in us by your Spirit.